This is Tom Rowe, and today on an expanded one-hour WGXC Evening News, we'll tune in the contentious April 19th Hudson Common Council meeting that revolved around the senior center funding. Also, holistic practitioner Fran Sussman talks about her work and experience with Lyme disease. We'll also hear reports about several pipelines proposed to crisscross the area and radio news about what the FBI paid to hack the San Bernardino terrorist iPhone. Also, with weather updates, town meetings, and the song of the day, today from Catskill's Brian DeWan on the WGXC Evening News. Tune in the WGXC Evening News weeknights at 6 p.m. on your Creative Community Radio Station, WGXC 90.7 FM and WGXC.org. Tune into local headlines, news from both sides of the Rip Van Winkle Bridge, interviews with local newsmakers and your neighbors in towns around the WGXC listening area. Tune in to WGXC Evening News weeknights at 6 p.m. on WGXC 90.7 FM and WGXC.org.
From the WGXC Newsroom, this is the WGXC Hands-On Radio Daily News and Weather Report for Tuesday, April 26, 2016. I'm Philip Grant. Jim Plank is reporting in the Daily Mail that the Greene County Legislature's Jail Committee is considering the possibility of relocating the County Department of Aging's Food Preparation Service to the proposed new county jail in Coxsackie. The department delivers 200 meals a day, and in 2015, a total of nearly 43,000 meals were served countywide. At a recent meeting, the committee discussed the differences between inmate meals and senior meals, State Department of Health regulations for transporting food, the potential cost of savings of the move, the advantage of having greater bulk food storage capability, and volunteers' reaction to the proposal. The jail requires serving 3 meals a day, but the Department of Aging's main focus is on serving or delivering 1 hot meal per day, with specialized nutritional needs for many of the seniors, making the feasibility of a shared kitchen improbable. County Human Services Director Terry McGee Ward said there was concern on the part of department cooking staff about working with incarcerated people, and the seniors the agency serves also have concerns. Ward said, and I quote, "The seniors have said, I'm not eating the food if an inmate prepares it," end quote. Cairo legislator Harry Lennon said the scenario was under consideration and would not happen. He reiterated that bulk food storage capacity is essentially now the focus. You can read that full story in the Daily Mail. John Mason is reporting in the Register Star that authorities are investigating a false deed scheme in several counties in the Capital Region. At least one of the target properties is located on 6th Street in Hudson, according to the state police. The scam works this way. The perpetrator creates fictitious documents for foreclosed or abandoned properties, naming themselves as trustee. They file those documents with the county clerk's office and then sell or rent the property, state police said. Columbia County Clerk Holly Tanner said the properties in the scheme are typically in foreclosure or belong to people who are deceased. State Police Investigator Andrew Biren said most of the alleged frauds of this sort involve property rentals rather than building sales. A property sale was recently attempted in Columbia County. The transaction was unsuccessful because discrepancies were identified by the realtor and the homeowner who went to the Hudson Police Department. To avoid being victimized by this scam, Biren advised people to do their due diligence. He said, and I quote, "If you see something that appears to be too good to be true, it probably is," end quote. Programmers note, Holly Tanner is an active WGXE programmer. You can read that full story in the Register Star. The New York State Canal Corporation announced this weekend that the state canal system will open for the boating season 4 days earlier than originally planned, 7 a.m. Wednesday, April the 27th. All other dates and hours for the 2016 navigation season remain the same. The New York State Canal System is a successor to the Erie Canal and other canals within New York. The 525-mile system is made up of the Erie, the Oswego, the Cayuga-Seneca, and the Champlain Canals. Information is available at canals.newyork.gov. Brian Nearing is reporting at Capital Confidential that the Cuomo administration on Monday, April the 25th, reminded health insurance carriers that they are required to offer maternal and postpartum depression screening. The Department of Financial Services issued guidelines that group health plans and insurers must provide, with no copayment, coinsurance or deductible, preventive services such as depression screening in pregnant and postpartum women. Insurers must begin to provide these services as soon as possible and no later than within 6 months. Previously, the recommendation for depression screening was limited to non-pregnant adults and only in instances where depression care supports were in place. You can read that full story at Capital Confidential, a Times Union blog. Here is an update. New York Governor Andrew Cuomo sent 70 additional state personnel to help combat the wildfire, which has now consumed 800 acres, on April 25th. There are now more than 110 state emergency personnel on the scene dedicated to containing the fire. Governor Andrew Cuomo's office sent more state emergency personnel to battle the wildfire at Sam's Point Preserve near Ellenville in Ulster County on April 25th. Over 40 state personnel from the Department of Environmental Conservation, Parks, Recreation, and Historic Preservation, State Police, Office of Fire Prevention and Control, and Office of Emergency Management are assisting at least 80 Ulster County first responders at the scene of the fire, which started on April the 23rd. Two helicopters with 250-gallon buckets are dumping water from local lakes onto the fire, according to Cuomo's office. Rain is expected today, April 26, which should help extinguish the flames. The New Platts Climate Action Coalition has announced a civil protest against the proposed Pilgrim oil pipelines will be held at three locations in the Hudson Valley on Sunday, May the 1st. According to a statement released by the coalition on Monday, April the 25th, protesters will be present between 1 p.m. and 3 p.m. at the New York State Thruway Exit 21, Catskill, and Exit 20, Saugerties, and from 3 p.m. to 5 p.m. at Exit 18, New Platts. The Pilgrim Pipeline proposal calls for shipping Bakken crude from Albany to Linden, New Jersey, through a pipeline that would roughly follow the Thruway corridor. Refined crude products would be returned to Albany via a parallel pipeline. The coalition claims this unneeded oil would further increase climate change. In addition to climate concerns related to the 178-mile pipeline, the group and its supporters are also focused on protecting waterways, public health and safety, the local regional economies, and air quality. You can read that full story at the Mayday Against Pilgrim Pipelines Facebook page. Brian Nearing is reporting at Capital Confidential that the Houston-based developers of the Constitution Natural Gas Pipeline have vowed to challenge the State Department of Environmental Conservation's rejection of the project. Constitution Pipeline LLC announced on Monday, April 25th, and I quote, "It remains steadfastly committed," end quote, to the project and blasted the DEC for a ruling based on, and I quote, "flagrant misstatements and inaccurate allegations," end quote. Alleging the decision, and I quote, "appears to be driven more by New York State politics than by environmental science," end quote. The company said the decision came as no surprise and ran contrary to its efforts to work collaboratively with the state to address concerns. The company wrote, and I quote, "contrary to the DEC statements, the company was not informed of any outstanding issues that it had not agreed to address as a condition of the permit. In fact, during the past 9 months, weekly inquiries were made to the department to ensure no additional data was needed. Those inquiries were either ignored or responded to in the negative. It is obvious that the DEC deliberately chose to remain silent to bolster the political campaign of the state," end quote. The company said the permit denial will delay approximately 2,400 jobs expected to be created during the pipeline construction and generating $130 million in labor income. The decision could also cost local governments roughly $13 million in property tax revenue as well, the company said. You can read that full story at Capital Confidential, a Times Union blog.
National Weather Service in Albany says the rain should be over now with a low around 35 Wednesday morning. Wednesday should be sunny with a high near 55 and a low around 31. Thursday mostly sunny with a high near 58 and a low around 36. You're listening to 90.7 WGXC Acre.
This is Alana Medlock, and you are listening to the WGXC News Update. Yancey Roy in Newsday reports that State Attorney General Eric T. Schneiderman okayed online voter registration in Suffolk County. The Long Island County would be the first in the state to allow online voter registration. Assistant Solicitor General Catherine Sheingold wrote in the opinion that state election law would allow an electronic signature on a voter registration form. Schneiderman said the opinion opened, quote, a new era of truly online voter registration, an incredibly exciting step that will help make the state election process more accessible and simpler for all. Read the full story in Newsday. The Daily Freeman reports that rain April 26th dampened a wildfire at Sam's Point in the Minnewaska State Park Preserve, but it was still active in the afternoon and has now burnt an estimated 2,000 acres. Christopher Tarantino, public information officer for the state incident management team, said the brush fire would likely burn throughout the night despite rainfall. He also worries about the dry forecast for the rest of the week. Flames have risen as high as 80 feet, and Governor Andrew Cuomo's office sent 70 more firefighters to the scene April 26th. Read the full story in the Daily Freeman. Lee Whiteman, 20 years old from Chatham, won the 5K Sean's Run charity event April 24th in Chatham with a time of 16:37. Haley Madsen, 25-year-old from Ghent, finished first among women and 20th overall with a time of 20:12. The 15th annual Sean's Run event raises money for programs in schools to combat underage drinking, impaired driving, and lax use of seatbelts by teens, and to award scholarships to deserving college-bound high school seniors. Timothy Knight in the Watershed Post reports that former State Assembly Minority Leader John Faso, who is running for the Republican nomination in New York's 19th congressional district, was also a lobbyist for the Constitution Pipeline since serving in Albany. The Constitution Pipeline, one of four proposed to crisscross the area, was denied permits by the state's Department of Environmental Conservation on April 22nd. The pipeline would have run from northern Pennsylvania to Schoharie County, largely along I-88. Faso, who is based in Kinderhook, defended the natural gas that would flow through the pipelines. Quote, the reason New York State has had an almost 25% decline in carbon dioxide is because we replaced coal with natural gas, Faso said. Millbrook Oil executive Andrew Heaney and Hamden businessman Robert Bishop are running against Faso in a June 28th primary election. Read the full interview in the Watershed Post.
And that wraps up the WGXE Hands-On Radio Daily News and Weather Report for today, Tuesday, the 26th day of April 2016. From the WGXC Newsroom, I'm Philip Grant. Have a good day and a pleasant tomorrow.
Today on the WGXC Evening News, we first tune in the contentious April 19th Hudson Common Council meeting about senior center funding.
So, could I add another question? I hope, as far as I hear that the county will be good to decide. They already passed the passed the resolution already. So it will be, I think it will be what with us.
Okay, all right.
So,
I think
county passed the resolution 0.1
commitment. Does anybody on this council have a recommendation on how they'd like to move forward with these three resolutions? Oh boy, hands up. Excuse me?
Motion to vote.
Motion to table.
Yes.
No. Bingo.
Yes. Table. Too many things right around here.
Yes, but this is like a half-finished grocery list, and you're going to end up with vodka and batteries, and you're going to be hungry the next week. This is ridiculous.
Well, let's have a special meeting.
And well done.
I have no shame to vote. Let's just
continue. I want to say
something. That's going to be on public access. You guys can rewind that later. Hear that funny quip.
We We have a motion and a second to vote. On which one?
Which one do you want?
Should we combine them all in one?
Like a triple net lease.
$54,000
Second,
second,
second.
Top.
I like it.
All right, okay. And third is the
11,000. What's the one that's up right now?
54.8.
Which 54.8?
The youth department.
We have a introduction in a second. Bob and Tiffany. Roll call vote.
President DeStefano.
No.
Al McDonoghue.
Aye.
Friedman.
No.
Garriga.
Aye.
Haddad.
No.
Keith.
Aye.
Mia.
Aye.
Moore.
No.
O'Hara.
Aye.
Rector.
No.
Scalero.
How dare you even say that, Bob?
This is something that needs to be done.
I wasn't the only one. Is she teams with him too over there?
I'm sorry, what did you say?
I'm teaming up with her.
What does that even mean? What is insinuation? What could that... What are they insinuating?
Youth department.
I appreciate it.
Ayes, 1,009 nays. The resolution passes.
Keep in mind,
we just keep throwing money out. Right. Anybody who needs money should line up.
Keep in mind, needs approval of the DEA before
it's valid. This resolution is coming on this floor without BEA approval.
Okay.
Probably should have waited.
Okay, that's fine.
Excuse me, I have just a point of procedure. What would be the proper way to do it? Go to BEA first?
It's not clearly set out. It says it's upon request of a department or it needs approval of the two, but it doesn't actually set out a sequence.
Right. Because I didn't hear in that description a sequence in which the council would initiate anything.
The commissioner made the request, and I had said earlier that because it's a request, it could needs approval of the BEA and the council, the commissioner could withdraw it.
Right.
But then you said, well, the commissioner made the request, but has never withdrawn it.
Hmm.
So he said that, and that's one of the bases for going forward. And that it was not withdrawn by the person who made the request.
Yes.
That was, and so the request is still effective and needs approval of the council and the BEA. There isn't a clear sequence set out in the code or the charter. So they're two independent.
Three.
It seems that perhaps historically it's gone to the BEA first and hasn't come here without it because it would be moot. But it's not clear that it is required to be done that way.
Mm-hmm. And although, why would the BEA take something up unless the council was behind it? It's the other way to think of it. Yeah.
Or why would we go through a procedure that we've done for so long?
It just says that the request needs approval of the two.
Right.
Great.
Ladies and gentlemen, without any regard to the merits of the issue. In the resolutions, it seems to me that I have a slight difference with council's interpretation of the authority of the BEA, because if indeed the BEA is is required prior to the submission of a resolution to the council. That, in effect, is a veto of council action. And I do believe that both state statute and the absence, if not the presence, of language in the charter suggests that the council has the authority. It has practiced this authority on numerous times to expend, you know, to appropriate, to authorize and expend funds. As to whether or not the resolution should be properly written before it comes to the council, yes, the rules of order that are passed at the beginning of each council specify that a resolution that comes to the council should be in written form. If it's coming from a committee, should come in written form. Now, of course, it also that section of the rules of order also specify that the chair, that the president of the council, can waive that requirement. But there is a practice there that assumes that indeed written resolutions, finished resolutions, do come before that are supposed to come before the council. But I do think that the larger question with which I started is that indeed I would be very careful about assuming that the BEA is dispositive, has authority over whether or not a spending resolution can come to the council, because that in effect is an automatic veto. In effect, the BEA can say you can't spend money.
In fact, the BEA can say you can't spend money, and a new appropriation requires BEA approval, requires approval of both this House and the BEA, which includes the executive, and that is the check and the balance. And that's exactly how it's supposed to work. Both sides have to approve, or we don't spend the money. The part that you were right about is that this should be in writing, this should be considered, we should understand.
John, I disagree with you. I think that that
the BEA says where the money comes from, if it's to be spent. There has to be, you have to have money going to an account and money coming from an account. But I would be very surprised if it was upheld that the mayor's veto authority is the power that the executive branch has to counteract an expenditure of which it does not approve.
Ellen, I believe that maybe Donna said this. I'm not sure, but does the resolution before you state where the money is going to come from? No. What fund is it coming from? Then it's certainly illegal or wrong. And it's a budget amendment, isn't it?
It's coming from fund balance.
Right. It's coming out of your pocket.
It says that in the resolution? Isn't that a budget amendment of a sort?
Mm-hmm. Sure is.
Yes. Yes. So it needs to be yet.
It's a new appropriation.
That's
what
you've
said.
Bill?
I certainly appreciate the supervisor's opinion. I just want to say, go back. And first say, Alderman, excuse me, Mia has been working pretty hard on this from the beginning of the year, and I certainly would like to commend him on his efforts. With that being said, though, the mayor is right now making the decision based on budget, based on new incoming information, and I know all of us, or most of us in this room, were certainly ready to see a senior center up and running, especially some of you who are sitting on the Youth and Agent Committee, and I know there's been a lot of conversation. But there has been new factors. We are talking about new details, and I certainly, a month can't hurt. So, if we set back, thought about the facts a little more, we probably could go forward with a better decision. And on the county position, we have three supervisors here, and I can tell you that it is going through two committees to date. We have two more committees, the last of which will be in the second week in May. So the position will probably, if things continue to go as they are, the position will be available at that time. But I just think that if cooler heads were to prevail today and we were to rethink about this and allow the conversation to continue to go, and we're all on the same page, it just seemed like we're arguing from different points. And I think we could it could come together a little better if we were to have a broader discussion on it.
Moving on to the next resolution, which is...
You did the
the resolution, the first, the next resolution will be the one that includes the $7,500.
That's the total number at the bottom. Would be 11,000.
11,600.
$11,657.75.
Can I get a motion in a second?
To table it, I
motion
we table it.
Second.
Call
for a vote.
Roll
call vote.
Is that legal?
Aye.
That's how it works.
We had to get a motion to start each and every one singly.
Okay.
You did a motion, then you asked him which one did he want to start with.
Motion to table.
I don't think that's part of our council meeting.
Motion to table.
You said an introduction for all three, and then you asked him which one did he want to start with.
Motion on the table. Motion on the floor.
No, I took one at a time. I asked which one he wanted to start with, and he wanted to start with the youth department.
Everybody was discussing combining them all into one. And the discussions going back.
Roll call vote.
Minute one.
To table the resolution.
To table the resolution.
President DeStefano.
Aye.
Alderman Donahue.
No.
Friedman.
Aye.
Garriga.
No.
Haddad.
Aye.
Keith.
No.
Mia.
No.
Moore.
Aye.
O'Hara.
Aye.
Rector.
Aye.
Spiller. I'm sorry. No.
You're listening to radio news about radio waves. Headlines from the ether. Headlines.
This is Tamer with the radio news about radio waves. Darren Orff at Gizmodo rounds up what the public knows now about the Apple versus FBI case of the San Bernardino terrorist iPhone. FBI Director James Comey admitted to a crowd in London April 21st that the U.S. government paid someone to hack open the iPhone. He said they paid them more than Comey would make for the remainder of his 7 years and 4 months as FBI director, which is at least $1.34 million. Comey says, quote, "It was, in my view, worth it," unquote. Although all reports indicate the FBI did not find any useful information on the phone. Perhaps Comey is referring to the legal fees saved, as the Justice Department ended its lawsuit against Apple when the FBI broke into the phone. Read the full story at Gizmodo. This is Tom Rowe for Waveform Radio and WGXC.
Environmentalists are praising a decision by the state's Department of Environmental Conservation that could halt construction of a natural gas pipeline. As world leaders gathered in New York City on Friday to sign the Paris Agreement on Climate Change, the DEC issued its decision denying a key permit for construction of the Constitution Pipeline, According to attorney Monine Naismith with the group Earth Justice, the pipeline builders failed to provide a large amount of critical information about the potential impact on water quality.
There are 251 stream crossings in New York State, and essentially Constitution evaluated 11. That's just not good enough.
The gas and oil companies proposing the project said they are examining the DEC's decision and are considering their options, which could include an appeal in court. The gas companies say the pipeline would help lower the costs of natural gas in a region with some of the highest prices in the country. But Naismith says studies suggest that additional natural gas pipelines aren't necessary.
The existing pipeline infrastructure that we have might be completely adequate with certain small changes to supply the existing needs of both New York State and New England.
Just days before the DEC denied the permit for the Constitution Pipeline, another pipeline project in Massachusetts was canceled by the developer for insufficient contractual commitments from customers in the New England market. But the Constitution Project has caused some damage in Pennsylvania. Naismith points out before the permit was denied, the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission, or FERC, had allowed the company to clear-cut trees along a 20-mile stretch of the proposed pipeline route.
So we would hope that FERC looks at this and realizes that it cannot allow Constitution to proceed with a pipeline to nowhere and go forward with any of the building in Pennsylvania.
For Public News Service, I'm Andrea Sears. When a parent goes to prison, the effects on their children can be devastating, but a new report says there are ways to lessen the impact. Nationwide, more than 5 million kids, including 148,000 in New York, have seen a parent go to jail or prison. Scott Spencer with the Annie E. Casey Foundation says for the child, that can be as traumatizing as abuse, domestic violence, or divorce.
There are some long-standing impacts. It can increase a child's mental health issues, such as depression and anxiety, and it can hamper educational achievement in that child.
The Casey Foundation's report, A Shared Silence, outlines policy recommendations to help children and parents cope with incarceration and with reintegration as a family after a release from prison. While the majority of incarcerated adults in New York are from New York City, most state prisons are upstate. Spencer suggests one way to help kids is for judges to take family into consideration during sentencing and prison assignment.
Location can matter in how a child can have access to their parent while that parent is incarcerated, and providing other ways for kids to connect with their families using technology such as video conferencing.
Other measures can help parents provide for their families after they're released from prison, including housing rules that don't discriminate against people with records. New York City recently passed a ban the box law, removing questions about criminal convictions from employment applications. Spencer says several states and dozens of other cities have passed similar laws.
They defer the question about a person's record to the conditional employment stage so that they have more stable footing to be able to apply for the job and qualify for the job.
The report says 65% of families with a person in prison struggle to meet basic needs. For New York News Connection, I'm Andrea Sears.
And for our final story, the details of two more adopted school budgets have emerged. Melanie Lekachevic is reporting in the Daily Mail that the Coxsackie-Athens Board of Education last week adopted that district's 2016-17 spending plan, totaling $29.9 million and requiring a 0.5% tax levy increase. The district was able to stay within the state-mandated tax cap. At the same time, it increases spending by nearly $500,000. There will be no staff reductions and no academic programs will be cut. The school board election is uncontested. Three candidates are seeking three open seats. A public hearing on the budget will be held May the 3rd at the elementary school in Coxsackie, on May the 5th at the elementary school in Athens. The Germantown Board of Education unanimously approved that district's 2016-17 budget at a meeting on April 13th, according to a report from Debbie Mayer in the Columbia paper. The $14.8 million spending plan requires a 0.64% tax levy increase. To keep the tax levy increase below the state cap, the district will have to tap its unreserved fund balance. A public hearing on the proposal will be held Wednesday, May the 4th, at the school. Residents will also vote to fill two seats on the Board of Education. Ralph Del Pozo, Lester Olson, and George Sharp Sr. are competing to fill those seats.
Holistic practitioner Fran Sussman is the interview next. She was interviewed on the Roots Runners Rhizome show on WGXC April 25th by Sarah Faulkner and Lauren Gambierone.
Hello, welcome to Roots Runners Rhizomes, Radical Health and Healing from the Underground. I'm Sarah Faulkner.
And I'm Lauren Gambierone.
Welcome to the show. We are here. We will be talking with holistic practitioner Fran Sussman, who I had the pleasure of experiencing as a presenter at the New Paltz Lyme Support Group a couple weeks ago. We've spoken about this support group before. One of our previous guests, herbalist Heather Bruntill, told us about it. It's a great resource for folks living with and healing from Lyme. So, but today, let's see, since 1993, holistic practitioner Fran Sussman has helped thousands of clients reclaim their health and well-being, often in ways they never had it before. Her strengths include teaching people to heal the gut and reduce inflammation, helping women to balance hormones naturally in every stage of life, restoring metabolism, healing the brain, Lyme disease, and much more. She is based in Orange County and works with clients both in person and long distance. Her personal journey includes full recovery from breast cancer as well as from chronic Lyme disease. At the age of 62, she is grateful to live a life rich in purpose, joy, service, health, and vitality. In addition to a thriving private practice, Fran teaches online courses, including the upcoming Zen Vitality Detox, which starts this Thursday, April 28th. This is a different kind of detox, integrating clear nutritional guidance, healthy treats, and simple practices that have huge payoffs for body, mind, and spirit. Participants consistently call Fran's teaching transformative and life-changing. Fran, are you here on the line?
I am here with you, yes.
You can hear us? Great. Welcome to the show, Fran. Thanks so much for being here today.
Thank you for inviting me.
Terrific. So, Fran, we just read a little bio for our listeners, but can you tell us a little bit about yourself, where you're from, and how long you've been in the area, if you're not originally from here?
Sure. Much to my amazement, I have now been in the Hudson Valley for 30 years, so almost half my life.
Wow.
The first half, I was really such a gypsy, and it still astounds me that I've settled down here, and I love it. And for the past 23 years, I've been a holistic health practitioner, and that also, I mean, I had several careers before that. Each of them was satisfying in their own way, but this is really the love of my life, to be able to help people to reclaim their health. And I just can't imagine anything more gratifying to be doing for my profession.
Awesome. So you just mentioned you had some careers before being a holistic practitioner. Can you tell us how all that evolved and how you came to start doing the work that you do now?
Sure. In my 20s, I was actually a market research consultant in New York City. I had a very successful career that I kind of fell into, and it made me ludicrous amounts of money. And it was fun. I mean, it really was. I got to travel all over the world and tell CEOs what to do. I was having a great time. But after a number of years of that, I really had to face the fact that I didn't want to help Nabisco sell more cookies. And I wanted to find work that was really more consistent with my values while still having that process that I enjoyed so much, which was really largely about problem solving and thinking of issues in a different way than they're usually thought of. And I had ideas about what I was going to move into next, and then, of course, life took a different route. So what happened was that I moved up to Orange County to have horses and children. I don't really have either anymore. The horses are long gone, and my children are grown. But what happened was that when they were both babies, really in the first year for each of them, they had health issues that their pediatrician couldn't figure out, couldn't solve to my satisfaction. And then I went to alternative doctors and alternative healers, and I just wasn't satisfied. So I really started studying this on my own, and what began to happen was that not only did I get answers for my children, who completely recovered from what they were dealing with, But I found that people started to call me and say, can you help my daughter? Can I give your name to my cousin? Can I come over and ask you about this? And so that's really how my practice started. And that was over 25 years ago, and I've just kept studying and training and working ever since. And then, you know, I say it's like three legs of a stool with my two children being two legs, but the third leg was really my own life, because, I mean, at that point, I don't think I even realized how ill I was. That, I mean, at that point, I already had Lyme disease. I was mildly depressed and very anxious and have been my whole life. But, you know, I was used to that. That was my normal. So I didn't really know that was something wrong.
Mm-hmm.
But I did know that I was very unhappy and my marriage was falling apart. And I'd been years of therapy. So I had a really good understanding, but it wasn't helping me to make changes in my life.
Mm-hmm.
And that's really that third leg, that I started, pushed by my own unhappiness, to look at other ways of healing, because clearly just the intellectual part wasn't doing it. So I do think understanding is essential, but I don't think it's enough.
Mm-hmm.
Fran, could you tell us a little more about what holistic health practitioner means for our listeners? Like, what exactly your practice is and what it includes?
Sure.
And let us know.
Yeah. And again, this is how I practice. I certainly don't want to define it for anybody else.
Right.
And my practice has evolved over a quarter of a century. When I first started out, I was first drawn to homeopathy. And so I trained in classical homeopathy, which I still love and still use. But as I was apprenticing with a couple of different homeopaths, it kind of startled me that all they had to do, I mean, they always had to give people a homeopathic remedy, and that was the extent of their toolbox. And I thought, I don't want to be limited like that, because I didn't think that everybody always needed a homeopathic remedy, or even if they did, that that would always be the best thing to do. And so my practice is very eclectic.
Welcome to the Public News Service Daily Newscast for Tuesday, April 26, 2016. I'm Mary Sherman. Cruz and Kasich align to stop Trump as voters in five states head to the polls. A life-saving medicine that can save an addict from overdose up for debate in Maine. And health experts prescribing more tall glasses of water for Americans. Those are among the stories we're highlighting today. At the top of the list, ahead of nominating contests in Pennsylvania, Connecticut, Rhode Island, Delaware, and Maryland today, Republicans John Kasich and Ted Cruz made a pact to try to stop Donald Trump from securing the Republican nomination. Kasich said he'd no longer compete in Indiana, and Cruz said he'd pull out of New Mexico and Oregon.
It is big news today that John Kasich has decided to pull out of Indiana to give us a head-to-head contest with Donald Trump.
But there is uncertainty in the plan, as Kasich later declared his supporters in Indiana should still vote for him. Trump, who's expected to lead in today's primaries, blasted the deal.
And actually, I was happy because it shows how weak they are. It shows how pathetic they are.
In the Democratic race, a public policy polling survey on Monday showed frontrunner Hillary Clinton leading rival Bernie Sanders ahead of the primaries in Connecticut and Pennsylvania, while Sanders has the edge in Rhode Island. While the presidential candidates have clashed over gun control, legislation to strengthen background checks for gun buyers in Minnesota gets a public hearing today in the Senate Judiciary Committee.
The bill would require universal background checks for anyone who buys firearms in the state. Current Minnesota law does not require that private sellers use background checks when transferring gun ownership. Supporters of Senate File 2493, including Merritt Brock with the group Moms Demand Action for Gun Sense, say even if someone can't pass a check, they can still find a way to get a gun.
About 40% of all gun sales in Minnesota happen without a background check. And those happen between individuals or at gun shows or at internet sales.
The Minnesota Gun Owners Civil Rights Alliance, however, argues that the bill would be an overreach by state government and won't stop gun violence. I'm Brandon Campbell reporting.
The city of Cleveland, Ohio has agreed to pay $6 million to the family of Tamir Rice to settle a lawsuit over the 12-year-old's fatal shooting by a police officer. The payment will avert a federal civil rights case brought against the city by Tamir's relatives over the death. Tamir was shot dead by an officer who opened fire just 2 seconds after arriving at a park where the 12-year-old was playing with a toy gun. The court filing states, though, there is no admission of wrongdoing. To save a life or not, that's the question at the core of the debate brewing over the veto by Maine's governor of a bill that would provide easier access to a life-saving drug overdose antidote. More from Mike Clifford.
Kenny Miller is co-founder of the Maine Harm Reduction Alliance. He says last week's veto by the governor makes no sense, either in terms of helping Mainers survive addiction or the governor's pro-life stance.
He's implying that people should just hurry up and die. People do recover, and there are many people who have recovered from opioid use disorders and, you know, gone on to live long, healthy, productive lives.
In his veto message last week, Governor LePage said naloxone does not truly save lives. It merely extends them until the next overdose. Miller says by his group's count, the legislature had the votes needed to override a veto prior to the governor's remarks. He says they are now regrouping and haven't ruled out an override attempt later this week.
Community health centers in Colorado are struggling to recruit and retain doctors, but they could catch a break if new legislation becomes law. House Bill 1047 would speed up the process for putting out-of-state doctors to work by entering into an interstate agreement or compact. Dr. Joan Bothner with Children's Hospital Colorado says under current rules, doctors already licensed in other states have to wait months before seeing patients in Colorado.
So it's important to the state of Colorado really to be able to take care of both our own constituents and then also the constituents in the state surrounding us. And especially as rural as some of our regions of the state are, sometimes it's easier for physicians who are licensed in other states to come into Colorado to provide that care.
12 states have already joined the compact. We're still not drinking enough water. A new report by the CDC says there are certain groups of people who need to drink more to protect their health.
The CDC has followed up on a study that was done about a decade ago that looks at whether Americans are drinking enough water. In its updated report released today, CDC researchers say women drink more water than men, and older Americans need to try harder to stay hydrated. It's recommended men get 125 ounces of water a day and women 91 ounces, and that includes not just drinking water, but water from all food sources. Asher Rossinger with the National Center for Health Statistics says the results mirror those in the earlier study. Senior citizens, in particular, aren't drinking enough.
Adults 60 and over are the most vulnerable population among adults to dehydration. And by doing this report, we're able to kind of quantify how much they're drinking on a given day and whether they might be falling short of the amount of water they're consuming.
The study also looks at hydration based on race and ethnicity. It says Hispanic and African Americans also are drinking less water than they should, especially the men in those groups. I'm Veronica Carter reporting.
It's research that might make you feel itchy, but it is helpful. A study published Monday in the Journal of Medical Entomology finds bed bugs strongly prefer red, black, and avoid green and yellow. But researchers noted these are early findings, so it's not necessarily time to run out and buy new bed sheets. I'm Mary Sherman for Public News Service, member and listener supported, and online at publicnewsservice.org.
The National Weather Service in Albany says the rain should be over now with a low around 35 Wednesday morning. Wednesday should be sunny with a high near 55 and a low around 31. Thursday mostly sunny with a high near 58 and a low around 36. You're listening to 90.7 WGXC Acre. This is Timer with the local community calendar. Anybody can add an event to the WGXC community calendar at wgxc.org. Just go to the calendar there and click on add an event at the top of the page and copy and paste the information about your community event. Soon, folks like me will read about it on the radio. Folks around the world will see it at wgxc.org. On Wednesday, April 27th, Hudson has a DPW committee meeting at 5:30 p.m. and a legal committee meeting at 6:15 p.m. at the Hudson City Hall, 520 Warren Street. Wednesday, April 27th, Catskill has a village meeting, the Washington Irving Senior Center. That's at 7 p.m. Those are the only meetings for the last Wednesday of the month. And since there is a public hearing in Catskill today, we'll hear today's song of the day from Brian DeWan, a little ditty that might just be about Catskill.
This is another kind of municipal kind type song called The Ever-Improving Village. And Pepto-Bismol sunset tips aslant. It seeps into the water table like a sewage treatment plant. Rust park swing set screeches on which feral children play. Their hollers strain through chain link fences all the mean dog day. Left at Colonial Drug, the local den of sin. Kitty corner across the street from the horse and buggy motor inn. A crooked mile past Murderer's Creek, just north of Indian Head Hill, lies our ever-improving village on the banks of Thornbush Kill. Powers that be won't likely vote for doing something rash, like plow the streets or fill in potholes or pick up household trash. Listen to the sea and the sun of peace we say. What mart up, invoking eminent domain, in hopes it will kill off the local business that remains. Yet once there was an ordinance that you couldn't build no higher than the statue of William Penknife or the second parish spire. Wayward youth will enter our state-of-the-art brand spanking new juvenile detention center. Get your kicks at the 5 and 10 or the 12-lane bowl-a-drone. The Ace of Burgers, the Rummage Roost, or the gloaming old folks' home. Got the county's largest junkyard, which truly does deserve to be declared an accidental wildlife reserve. And in spite of all you've heard, about the underground oil spillage. You gotta admit, we've got a heck of a view from our ever-improving village. We're not so bad, we're getting better in our ever-improving village.
Hear the local news in a different way beginning May 2nd on WGXC. Tune in all together now, 6 p.m. Monday through Saturday on 90.7 FM WGXC.